This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself, who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes, and there are several features that really impressed me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think, teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show CRNA and the CEO of Revitalist, Catherine Walker. And this time she's joined by clinical pharmacist Nick Nowak and British military veteran David Norris. Now, in this conversation, we have three unique perspectives when it comes to the world of ketamine and mental health. So from Catherine's experience from the medical side, Nick's experience from the pharmacy side, and David's experience as a recipient, this is a very powerful, multifaceted perspective on this entire discussion. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So that being said, I introduce to you Catherine Walker, Nick Nowak, and David Norris. Enjoy. Katie, David, and Nick, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you. Glad we're here.
James, it's a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much, James. Excited to kick off the conversation.
All right. So I know that we've got a shorter time frame. For people listening, Katie was on episode 559 and then back on with Nick Murray on episode 678. So we took deep dives into the world of ketamine and Katie's your own life story. So why don't we just do a brief overview of everyone's background, and then we'll dive into, you know, the problems that we're seeing and then some of the solutions that you guys are going to be bringing today. So David, let's start with you. Tell me a little bit about your kind of background, some of the uniforms that you've worn, and how you find yourself having this conversation today.
James, thank you. Very embarrassing. I can't tell you that much. I served for 33 years in the British Army. Saw too much, did quite a lot, and I ended up suffering from PTSD. And I found that the traditional approach doesn't help. I needed something different, something new, something that actually worked. So I ended up having psychedelic assisted therapy, and it gave me my life back. So that's where I come from. I also, back in the UK and latterly internationally, was heavily involved in using sport to help wounded, injured and sick servicemen and women recover. That ended up with us having a relationship with the Warrior Games in Colorado Springs, and ultimately led to the birth of the Invictus Games. And the one thing that annoyed me through that journey was it was really, really simple to deal with people with visible wounds. Next to impossible to help servicemen and women with invisible wounds. So that's been a passion of mine, is how do we help people with these invisible wounds? And how do we move the needle from cure, our traditional approach, which doesn't really work? The individual's already hurt, their family, their friends, their work, their community, to prevent. How can we get ahead of the problem and actually help people before they've got a problem? So that's why I'm here.
We've had a lot of conversations with, you know, American veterans on the show, but, you know, obviously our cultures are slightly different. What is it through a British lens that you've seen that's created this stigma around the mental health when, for example, people like Mark Ormerod, who's an incredible man, I've had on him a couple of times now, you know, like you said, they look at him like, wow, triple amputee, we need to take care of this guy, he needs, you know, prosthetics and all the things. Why is there disconnect in the British military when it comes to the mental health side?
Oh, I think Jim, I think you can put down a couple of things. One is we're all meant to be alpha males as soldiers, so we don't talk about our weaknesses, or we don't like showing weakness. And certainly, if I think of the first time that I ended up saying to people, "I need help," it was still taboo. I had other people considering me weak for saying that I had a problem. And the only good news I had was I had became a dear, dear friend who sadly died recently, who said, David, for speaking out, is stronger than the rest of you. But I think we still have that. I think we still don't like talking about something that we don't necessarily understand. Very easy to understand an amputee. Not so easy to understand what's going on upstairs.
One of the things I think that I've seen that I think can help us connect with some of the naysayers, some of the still believe that kind of faux machismo version, is performance. When you have a busy mind, you're not going to be able to get into the flow state. You're not going to be able to perform at the highest level. I'm making an assumption now that you worked in some high level areas of the British military. What is your perspective now on performance with, you know, as you started struggling, how that affected your performance? Because I think it's a different lens that gets you the same result.
Yeah, I think it is. I think if I look at our experience in the British military, we went on operations, you came back, they literally tried to parachute you straight back home. Doesn't work. You're still on a high from being on operations. And when you get back in your home environment, they're not. An operational tour for me would feel like days, not months. For my family, it would feel like years, not months. So somehow you've got to get people back down to the same level, come down off that operational high you were on, and grasp reality again. You on an operational tour, you were ultra-focused on the mission at hand. And everything else was excluded. I think that's how you coped, but that didn't help you when you got home.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Nick, let's move to you. I know you've got a very different background. You weren't sequel squirreling around the British Isles. So talk to me about about your journey and what's brought you to this conversation.
Yeah. Thanks so much, James. Interesting mix of people we have on the call. So I'm excited to see how this all goes. My name is Nick Nowak. I'm a board certified clinical pharmacist. Most of my career has been on the clinical side. So I've worked in emergency medicine, cardiovascular ICU, including was at David Grant Medical Center, which is on Travis Air Force Base, for about 5 years. And then my other portion of the clinical background is more like integrative preventative medicine. And how do we really focus on the whole health and the whole human in order to take a more proactive approach to care? And the way I guess I'm on this call is ultimately just like frustrated with the current system. So a recent founder of a company called Miko Health. Miko, we built a nationwide in-clinic ketamine provider network. So we created rigorous standards for all those clinics, and we're focused on the employer benefit channel, including frontline workers, where often various mental health conditions may be more prevalent than the general population. I stepped away from that role, but still very active in the overall integrative mental health space for from a political standpoint and from a like support and consulting standpoint.
I asked this to a lot of the physicians. It'd be interesting to get your perspective. When I ask our doctors, how much education did you get on prevention, on sleep, exercise, nutrition, time in daylight, all these things? It's very little, and they normally chuckle right before they give their answer. And you learn that a lot of these medical programs are actually funded by pharmaceutical companies. Through a pharmacist lens, what is the education on the prevention side of pharmacology?
Very little. The two examples that come, that's a great question too. I love that. Cause it really highlights some fundamental flaws when we go when we're focused on a sick care system as opposed to a healthcare system. And from a sick care mindset, I would say, for mental health, it was all symptom management. It's here's a pill, take the pill. The pill doesn't work. Try the next pill, repeat. And that seems like silly to take a medicine for a complex human, try it for, I don't know, 6 to 8 weeks, and then try the next one, and then try the next one. It's like an unscientific, unrigorous process. And so what you were touching on as well, diabetes comes to mind, right? Diet, exercise, like really putting in that effort. But clinically, what we see is you have diabetes. Yeah, diet, exercise, eat some apples, but really here's your medicine. And let's focus on the medicine. Let's educate on the medicine and let's do the medicine. Without providing tools for just overall support and betterment of well-being.
When I think of the FDA, let's remove vaccines from this conversation completely. I think of an organization that approved OxyContin, which led to the opioid crisis that we have today. And I think of the organization that just denied MDMA to be used as a psychedelic-led therapy. What is your perspective experience on either the support or the barrier to healing modalities through that organization?
Yeah, oof. We could talk on that one for a little bit. So I did an internship at the FDA in Rockville, Maryland a number of years ago in the Division of Bioequivalents or the generic drug arm of the FDA. And I have a really deep respect for all of the individuals within the FDA and what they are striving for. I feel like our overall infrastructure is where barriers are coming in. I don't know a clear pathway forward, but like ultimately they've helped us out in like so many facets where other drugs have been approved in other countries and then weren't approved in the US, and we find they maybe have like teratogenic effects for pregnant women or other issues. So not without flaws, not without issues. We're seeing a lot of friction now as we touch on the psychedelic space. You touch on MDMA, which a synthetic molecule unfortunately was not passed on August 8th of 2024. But still like, yeah, deep respect for the rigor. I kind of danced around the question because there's a lot of loaded aspects in there. Yeah, and we took vaccines out of the picture, which also deep respect there.
Well, I think, I mean, it's not a black and white conversation, but it is. Yeah. You know, I mean, it obviously is an oversight for our safety, but when corrupted by certain individuals, you know, then it becomes a danger to the very people they're supposed to be protecting. So I think, you know, maybe kind of dissecting Absolutely. Them and fixing the things that are broken will make the overall system safer.
So here'd be my MDMA stance is if there was a world where we can have approval, but have a longitudinal study. So everyone who was receiving MDMA assisted therapy and have a large cohort of individuals and still consider them as part of the research, I'd be really excited about that, where we could have rigor, we could have a process, we can have access, and it's not fully released into the wild. And we've seen that on, I think, two drug occasions, if I'm not mistaken, where it was like a tentative approval to allow access.
Yeah, that sounds great. All right, well then let's move to Katie. Let's get your kind of origin story, Katie, your world into anesthesia and beyond.
So my background, nursing, worked in the hospital, did anesthesia for 10 years. James, I don't know, since we've talked, I went back and got my psychiatry degree too.
Because,
you know, everyone said, you know, with the anesthesia that I didn't know the brain, which actually I learned way more about the brain with anesthesia than I did with psychiatry. And so the more I learn, the more I know that we don't know. And there's three things here that, like, between what David and Nick said, is seeing the invisible, right, in mental health, is knowing that it is invisible wounds. But then also what Nick was saying, you know, with the FDA, they may not be bad people, but they're fragmented. And the whole healthcare system's fragmented. So it's basically, you know, the more money that you have in this space, the more that you're paying a fragmented system to view what you want them to view. And if there's not a lot of money in the space going towards a certain product, then that product's not going to be seen in any light. And that's, you know, with ketamine, there is no money in ketamine because it's too old for anybody to own. So that's why, you know, everybody's trying to come up with these new different pieces. So honestly, like, I think that it's a really big gap in knowledge. And that, I think that's our biggest flaw. Is in healthcare, we're very, very smart and we can't see what we don't know, but we know that we know it, right? So you're trying to go up against these smartest people in the world and tell them, well, wait a minute, you may not know this piece. And we're like, oh no, I know something. Like, I know there's a box. I know there's a bubble. I know we've got it all created. Like, we can put it somewhere. And what one thing I've noticed is the terminology doesn't exist yet. So when David says invisible wounds, yes, they are invisible right now. But the beautiful thing with the brain and what we're seeing with psychedelics and ketamine is if we can learn how to define, bring the terminology to it and actually make it diagnostic, we can bring that invisible piece to light. So it'd be the same way, you know, with open heart surgery, right? It's like, that's a very known thing that we do. And we have pretty good success with it. I mean, we saw people's chests open, you know, and then we stop their heart and we bring their heart back. We put their chest back together and then they live, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years afterwards. And this whole brain thing is just, you know, it's so dumbfounding to everybody that we're just like, oh, it's too complex. It's not too complex. We've just not identified the specific patterns with all of this. So the more specifics that we can get with it, especially psychedelics are showing us there's patterns. How do we define those patterns? How do we actually bring those patterns to light through a diagnostic lens? And when I say that, I'm not saying diagnoses. We suck at those in the mental health space. We're like up to 90% erred some cases. But if we can start bringing like lab reports or brain scans or heart scans and show people like, oh yeah, hey, look, when you have PTSD, you have this certain electrical abnormality in your heart. That's actually PTSD. It's the same place in the brain, you know? So we're seeing that there's these little pieces that we can bring our traditional knowledge and just kind of twist it a little bit to where we can make it fit into the psychedelic sector. So that's kind of where I'm at now. I mean, yeah, I know ketamine back and forth and I treat people pretty well, like from a clinical standpoint, I can assess them, but now I'm starting to see huge gaps and identifying the fragmentation and how do we integrate all of it. And it's going to be the hardest thing that we do because psychedelics are in the core. It's in the core of cardiology and neurology and psychiatry and psychology. Like, they're in the middle and they're changing everything, you know? So it's like, how do we now make this a new specialty that the traditional system can hear? And it's going to be hard because there's so many communication barriers, more than what we know.
It's an interesting path you've taken into the world of psychiatry. You know, one of the biggest comments I get from our veterans here in the US is I went there, they threw drugs at me and I left. When, you know, I asked Nick about the pharmacology route educationally, when you went through the psychiatric route, what was the pharmacological advice that you were given? Was there a prevention heavy element, or is it more leaning into the psychiatric meds rather than, you know, even exploring some of the other options that we're going to be talking about today?
that's all they talk about in psychiatry is how do you use a physician desk reference, right? How do you use a PDR? How do you use that, the pharmacy? How do you use this little book to help you to prescribe? That's it, basically, is what you're taught, you know? And then the advice is, personally, I think horrible, because, you know, it's like, start somebody on a drug. Oh, well, they're having an adverse effect or a side effect. And like, it tells you in the PDR, it says, like, the next step is to wait. And then the next step is to wait. And the next step is to wait, right? So you have to look at, like, from the anesthesia standpoint, like, that I'm coming from, literally, like, if you didn't change something in the next 10 seconds, somebody's dead, right? And in anesthesia, we're 99.9% effective. We get one bad outcome, one person out of 100,000 people. And then in mental health, we're 30% effective, if that. James, I don't know if you saw the STAR-D trial. Like, they're even now saying that the STAR-D trial, like, the numbers could potentially be even lower on efficacy than what they even thought. So we may not even be, like, we can even see how bad the system is because the data is so skewed. Like, it's almost like we should just go back to placebo in mental health and just start over. And that's kind of what psychedelics are letting us do. And I was telling Nick the other day, I made a really good point when I was at a talk last week. But I was talking about, you know, big pharma being a multi-trillion-dollar market, right? It's like the biggest market in the world. But what's the number one treatment for depression? The gold standard treatment. The gold standard treatment for depression since 1950, right? So 75 years ago, the number one treatment is ECT, shock therapy. So big pharma, while it's become a multi-trillion-dollar market, it has never been able to top us electrocuting someone's brain. But fortunately for us, psychedelics are actually showing that it's changing the electrical patterns in the brain. So, you know, so maybe if big pharma would have started looking at how do you auto-regulate, you know, too excited or not excited enough electrical patterns in the brain and made drugs that way instead of looking at all these chemicals that they thought it was, like, then maybe we wouldn't be in as bad of a situation that we're in. But it's there. It's the biggest, like, we're fighting the biggest, I don't know, the industry. I mean, it's not even an industry. It's the biggest thing in the world that we're trying to fight right now. As we're trying to advocate for people who are literally dying once every 20 seconds of suicide right now. So we've got a long ways to go.
Well, I think it's important to hear these perspectives. It's interesting when you talk about, you know, changing the electrical patterns. There's a technology out now that used to be a big box in high performers' rooms, whether it was NASA or the SEALs, called NUCOM. And the smartphones have become so advanced now, that's now an app. And that is the only one that's got the patent that it actually down-regulates the brain. It's a phenomenal technology. I use it. My mom uses it. My son uses it. And it's not, you know, snake oil. It's so, so good. That's NUCALM. But just hearing about the success stories there, that makes sense. And I've heard over and over again about the lack of efficacy. And this is important for us to know, because if you're not getting any benefits truly, but you're getting all these side effects, you know, what are you taking it for? And it's costing you, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. So, Nick, you've got a very unusual lens on this too. What are you seeing from a pharmacist lens on efficacy in this world? And what made you start leaning into the holistic space?
Yeah, and holistic might be a loaded term, but we'll run with it. Yeah, it was honestly in pharmacy school, it was, as mentioned, symptom management, daily pill. If not working, go to the next one. And the idea, and when we use the term psychedelic, just to clarify here, we're focused on ketamine therapy, which is available nationwide, all 50 states, United Nations list of essential medicines, MDMA still being researched, psilocybin outside of the country, as well as Oregon and Washington within the US have it legally available, along with multiple other agents there. So my deep interest, James, is the idea that someone going to have a medicine. So if we take ketamine, for example, the half-life will say about 2 hours. So it's out of the body in less than a day, and there's going to be intermittent doses, usually a session of six over 3 weeks. And potentially someone's not going to have to go back on that medicine ever again, as opposed to
standard pharmacology. It's in the body, and if it's not in the body, it's not working. The idea that a medicine could be given to an individual, to a human, and they might not have to be on it. The only other things that do that are antibiotics and some chemos, some oncology agents. And otherwise, like blood pressure meds, every other med is just symptom management.
Yeah. Well, I know even with MDMA, I've had years ago, Dr. Ben Sessa from Bristol University.
Sure.
And he was talking about it's three sessions and you're with, you know, mm-hmm. you're with a clinician. You're not taking it out on the street, which I had fun doing that in Japan years ago. It was a blast, but that's a whole different conversation. Which is probably one of the reasons why it helped. I had the mushrooms were legal in Japan too. So maybe I self-healed without realizing it. But joking apart, you know, it's not a prescription. You're not walking out taking these pills. You're sitting with a clinician or a therapist. You're doing the first session. I think it was 2 weeks later, you do the second one, 4 weeks after that, I think was the third. And then that's it. And they just saw, you know, improvement, improvement, improvement. So as you said, it's very rare that there's an exit strategy to a prescription. I think this is what's broken in the healthcare industry. Is there's no money in healthy people. There's no money in dead people. But if you can keep them on the pills for the rest of their life, then, you know, then you've got a customer forever. And if you look at the way, and it's not mm-hmm. like some evil doctor with a prescription pad, but the ethos around this, and you hear it with, you know, all the men and women that take it. Yeah, I'm on these and these. Oh, when are you going to get off? How much weight have you got to lose? You know, what have you done to change your eating habits? Are you hydrating? You know, what are you doing so that 6 months from now, you're not taking these pills anymore? That's not even in the conversation. They are assuming that they're going to take it till the day they die. And I think that mentality is completely broken as well.
100%. I think you nailed on that. With my time at Miko, a core tenet was really focused on agency. For if we were able to have patients create a sense of self-agency to help make those decisions and to drive their own life path forward, like that was our definition of success. And supported by the clinics such as Katie's being Revitalist and others nationwide. They're actually doing the care delivery.
So
something you touched on, James, and you may, the model here is totally different. Is so when you're touching on like pharmacy and pharmacy benefit managers and health carriers and this whole infrastructure, there's medical benefits and there's pharmacy benefits fundamentally broken down. This is the merging of both of those, which is really the first time we're seeing that. If someone is having a medicine and they're having a psychotherapist or therapeutic support paired with the medicine. And this is like first of its kind from a U.S. standpoint, mostly driven by organization called MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. I'm sure people are familiar. And then like Michael Midhoffer with MDMA research.
And Nick too, not only is it it's the pharmaceutical and the medical, it's the behavioral health. So you have to look at the way healthcare, it's all three different. When I said it's core earlier, we're having to merge. And merge means we're having to break their business model. Like everyone's going to be on the same level. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, David, let's pull you back in for a second. We were talking about, you know, some of the science a little bit. Walk me through your initial kind of therapeutics that were offered to you. And then, you know, how did you find yourself using ketamine?
So most of it was traditional, early days. And speak to somebody, pop a pill, you'll be okay. If you're not okay, pop another pill. And I suppose it suppressed everything, but it didn't actually cure at all. And then it was really my journey with things like the Invictus Games and meeting Katie and meeting Nick Murray that took me into there are different things, approaches that we can do that I haven't tried. I used some psychedelic assisted therapy with Katie and Nick, and brilliant. Also talking to a lot of US veterans that I know, and it's the journey that they've been on, not necessarily in the US, but overseas. And they will all tell you that it gave them their lives back. And to me, that's got to be better than our traditional approach, which numbs you, numbs the symptoms, numbs the problem, but doesn't give you a cure.
Well, there's this one kind of perception that, you know, ayahuasca is the magic pill and you just do it and everything's fixed. And then you, you know, learn to play the fiddle and ride a unicycle away into the sunset. obviously there's a lot of people that actually have been through it that talk about, okay, this is opening the door, and then you continue to unpack all the things that you need to address. And there's this kind of growth curve that you have. What was your experience? You know, what did that initial exposure to psychedelics do for you? And then what did you do to continue after that?
Okay, so I'm agnostic as to which. I think they all have a value. They all have a part to play. None of them alone are the silver bullet. So I won't say one is better than the other. Did I know what to expect? Not really. I do remember from my youth the film Yellow Submarine, and it wasn't that. It wasn't that kaleidoscope at all. But there was a clarity and an ability to look at the things that I was beating myself up about from a different perspective, and to understand them better, and to stop feeling guilty. And all of it for me was a guilt that I should have done more, that we should have done more, that I could have done more. Yeah, look at it in a different perspective. But to me, it's not just that treatment. It's a continual process. So there's a community that I'm part of that I keep in touch with. There are people that I can contact when I need to, or that will check in on me. And yep, I microdose. Fine.
Please jump in, Katie.
Well, so one thing thinking about this, and sorry, you all kind of highlighted on it, and I actually talked about this yesterday. The lack of training that we have as prescribers, whoever, right, in the medical space. When somebody presents to you with mental health issues, they look like they're moving so slow that they need help with learning how to move again. And if you are a person who's struggling with trauma symptoms or anxiety or whatever else, what's going on internally is moving so fast that all your energy is going into that. Like it's an overarching system, right? So as prescriber, we don't know, right? We're not taught like, oh no, like their brains are moving so fast. Like they can't stop. They can't slow it down. Like they can't sleep because the brain's still moving. So here as providers, what we're doing is we're trying to teach them like ADLs, right? Their activities of daily living. Here's how you should take a shower. Here's how you need to eat, right? And their brain's moving so fast. And here we are trying to teach them something. So what we have to do is to learn to auto-regulate, slow that brain down, and then there'll be more energy to do these things. And I think that's a really big piece. We're coming in and we're giving you pills. We're giving you stimulants a lot of times. Like in PTSD, they get a lot of stimulants. And so we're stimulating them to actually have more energy, but we're just feeding this beast that we can't see. And, you know, psychedelics auto-regulate that energy to a point. So when you're saying, you know, people's brains are speeding all the time, people in medicine don't understand that at all, right? Unless they're struggling with something, and then we don't admit any of that. So if we can teach providers and nurses and whoever else is dealing with the mental health community that when you talk to someone who's struggling to take a shower, they're struggling to sleep, they're struggling to eat, they don't know the last time that they ate or that they took a shower, it's not because they're moving so slow. It's actually because their brain's moving so fast. There is no energy left to actually do these tasks. And the only thing that they want is a moment of peace in their brain to breathe, to something. And so from a provider standpoint, we're probably, it's malpractice all the time, every day. Every day we're probably prescribing the wrong thing, giving the wrong interventions, putting the wrong strategies in place. And it's because we don't understand what's truly going on with those people. So if providers could sit down with somebody and actually have a really good conversation with someone who's struggling with anxiety or struggling with PTSD, instead of just being like, oh, I know what to do here if you got this, then we'll be able to start learning more about it. But until we do, we're going to continue to prescribe erred treatment regimens, which are even putting people at a higher risk of mortality.
Absolutely. Well, we talked about, you know, some of the psychedelics and MDMA not being approved yet. And I hope, you know, we'll have a conversation in a couple more years and this will be included in the toolbox for our veterans and first responders. But there is a lot of fear as far as, well, I can't take that, you know, workplace drug tests, you know, all the things. So talk to me about, you know, the unique element of ketamine, not only the therapeutic part, but also the legality of it as a mental health drug.
That's a great question. So ketamine under prescriber, it's under prescriber, right? It's like you can be getting ketamine therapies and continue to work. And they cannot legally hold that against you unless they think that you're going to be altered while you're doing your job. And what Nick said earlier, it's out of your system in 2 days. So I actually had a really good conversation with a pilot who's with FAA, who actually works with mental health. And he was saying that, you know, pilots can actually be diagnosed with depression and they can still fly. They can be on antidepressants and still fly. And I didn't know that. I didn't think that they could at all. But even the FAA is looking at ketamine now, which is huge, right? So it's this long lost intervention that we've never seen from people. So people are still, you can still get treatment. You can still work. Have we treated DEA agents? Yes. Have we treated federal agents? Yes. Have we treated veterans because ketamine's approved under the VA? Yes. You know, so it's people are afraid to get treatment because they're afraid their guns are going to be taken away, their job's going to be taken away, all these different pieces. And have we treated active duty police officers? Yes, we treated active duty police officers. And I have a sheriff and a deputy that are trying so hard to get ketamine approved for their guys under their insurance plan because they said just treating one officer changed the entire environment of the whole precinct. You know, so that's the piece. It's like we've got to get that out there. And when you take a medicine, and Nick could talk more about this, every time you take an antidepressant, it's changing the entire landscape of your brain. Like it's constantly changing all these different scenarios. Ketamine doesn't do that. It's in, turns the light switch on, turns it off, gets back out, and then your brain just starts operating on its own. Like it's a neuroregenerative piece. The brain can organically fix itself. That's what we need to hear is the brain can. And somebody said this earlier, I was speaking to a neuroengineer, which I thought was a cool degree to even get into. But he was saying the brain is an organ of learning. And he's right. It's continual learning. So if we're medicating it daily, we're teaching it other things. If we're able to do interventions, do the therapy, do the integration, whatever else, teach it peace, teach it calm, it can learn because that's what the brain's intended to do. Our entire lifespan is to learn. So how do we optimize that environment?
Well, Nick, I'll throw it over to you. I just want to put one thing in before we kind of hear your thoughts on that as well. So often I've heard of people, you know, either attempted or even completed suicide, and they were on psych meds. Even sadly, if you look at a lot of the school shooters, you know, psychiatric meds are involved. So talk to me about, you know, Katie just talked about the kind of changing the chemistry when it comes to being on these meds. What are the dangers? What are the side effects of some of these meds that, you know, we can actually replace with something like ketamine?
Oof, that is a loaded question there, James. Where do I start? I think philosophically and pragmatically, each of us as human beings are unique and different with some similar characteristics. And so to pin someone on antidepressants and school shooters is like more correlation. What else was happening for that person? What type of childhood do they have? Just so many questions come to mind. We need a better approach. And we need more rigor around what this looks like. Is it genetics? Are they a fast metabolizer? Are they a slow metabolizer? Do they try to stop their meds? Is it too high of a dose? I'm not educated enough to have a clear perspective on a causation for those aspects.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's a contributing factor. It's not by no means, you know, the thing. You know, there's violent video games, sleep deprivation, you know, trauma, all these other things as well. But it does seem to be one of the things on the pie chart almost every single time. And a lot of people I know that are suicidal have been on these meds. And you watch the TV commercials of these meds. can cause suicide ideation. Wait a second, an antidepressant causes suicide ideation? This maybe might be a red flag.
Yeah. I guess here'd be my like perspective on that. Of when we consider antidepressants, which actually atypical antipsychotics work better as antidepressants than what we consider antidepressants. So antipsychotics are a preferable agent in many cases. We don't use them often. And for, all the side effects. So like if we consider like whether it be like erectile dysfunction, like sexual habits, sleep disturbances, increased suicidality, like there's such a, we try to be so reductionist in our approach in medicine and get down to like a root cause of it. But I think we missed the mark. My high level on that. I danced a little bit, but Katie, what are your thoughts there? I know you have some big feelings.
I do. But yeah, again, this is all about, we've got to reframe the entire system with it. So when you talk about like ED stuff, right? It's like, you know, you get somebody who's depressed or suicidal and you put them on an antidepressant. Well, James, depression is not a direct correlator to suicide. So, you know, so it's like, why are we putting them on antidepressants when they're suicidal? Right. So again, it makes no sense. Like there's, you couldn't take somebody to court and get them to try to rationalize what they're doing because there's no rationalization to it. But thinking about psychedelics again and thinking about like erectile dysfunction, right? Like that's a huge piece, like having that connection with someone. You know, especially like if that's your safety or that's your trust or whatever else, and now you can't even contribute to that connection and with that oxytocin release and all this other stuff, and that's what they're going to get. It's like, you know, we're adding to their fire again. I mean, psychedelics allow you to reconnect with yourself, that allow you to see what you want to be aligned with. And people who do psychedelics, they're able to put everything that they want back into their relationship, right? Which improves all of that too. So no, I've read all the, you know, the inserts on the antidepressants, because I have a really big, and I don't know if Nick wants to talk about this, but I went down a big rabbit hole one time, because, you know, antidepressants, you're intended to be on them for 90 days. There's no long-term studies on antidepressants, but you know, we've got them, you know, people on them for 10, 20, 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And insurance is fine to cover that all day long. But also what happens when people are on these drugs for a very long period of time, a lot of them get really atypical liver failures. And they also get, you know, diabetes and all these other different pieces that no one's telling them about. And if you look on the inserts to the meds, it doesn't say that it causes, you know, like fatty liver or whatever else you want to say with liver dysfunction. But it does say that it like can change, you know, the plasma or whatever levels that may contribute to liver dysfunction. So there's a lot of things here. I mean, I know people feel like crap when they're struggling and they just want something easy, something light, you know, which is just a pill. Just take this one pill. That's all you have to do. They don't see how much damage that's potentially getting ready to be done in their situation. And then they'll look back and be like, oh my gosh, what if I would have done something else 20 years ago, like another intervention, right? But now they feel so far down the track that they're lost. It's like, you know, it's us. Again, James, you talk about the opioid epidemic. This is us as prescribers in the healthcare field creating this crisis again. It's us. We want to help. We do. But just because we have good intentions sometimes doesn't always mean that's what should be done. We're creating a really, really bad system, and it's going to get worse for a while until we can learn to create these new business models.
Well, you mentioned about, you know, the insurance companies having no problem continuing to cover the psych meds, but you've got this law enforcement agency fighting to get ketamine approved by their insurance. What is the barrier to entry to this therapy that's seeming to be so effective?
That's not long there, Miko.
Yeah, I know. So the company that I was recently part of and founder, Miko, was trying to crack that nut. And effectively,
It's an old drug that's off-label. So there's a brand name drug called Spravato, which is one portion of ketamine that's sprayed in the nose. Costs anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 per year. But it went through the formal FDA approval pathway. Ketamine, whether it be infusion or intramuscular or troches or other method, is approved in 1970s. Really, it wasn't until the year 2000 when Yale published a study on depression that we really realized that there was a compelling mental health use case for ketamine. Otherwise, it's just been this old drug that I've used in pediatrics in the emergency department. Katie's used it a ton in anesthesia. So like just a common old drug. And I think the pathway just comes down to it's not FDA approved. I've had like very high up decision maker conversations, and it just came down to the fact of it's not FDA approved for that indication. So we're not doing it. And that was it. I was like, here's real world evidence. Here's studies with 10,000 people. Here's compelling literature. I do feel, James, if you gave me a crystal ball, within 2 years, maybe three, I think ketamine will be FDA approved through the FDA, the first drug to go from generic to a new on-label indication. And the pathway is built for that now. And I really think that will happen, and we'll get there. But
well, and here's the thing. Yeah, and you can explain this more to James and David and maybe to me, but off-label prescribing is so common. And it's like, it's almost like 100% of the drugs, right, in the mental health field are off-label prescribing. And insurance will cover off-label prescribing of these meds. But people like prescribers, you know, they are off-label prescribing all the time. And they just don't know it. They don't know that, you know, if you're giving a secondary agent for depression or PTSD or anxiety, more than likely that's an off-label approach. But, you know, but even greater than mental health that's off-label is oncology. So if a chemotherapeutic agent, if they're given a secondary agent, which most of them do, those are all off-label prescribing, and insurance covers it all the time. But there's just some type of barrier with ketamine, be like, oh, nope, it's off-label, not going to cover it. But they do it all the time, James. All the time. I mean, like it's, you know, and that's the piece when I tell you, like, there's so much education here, because these people, like at the FDA, their world is their box. So you're trying to tell 10 boxes that they're all part of a bigger box, and they can't hear it, and they can't see it, and they've got a good paying job, and they don't want to see it because it's easy now. They've got a good business model. But, you know, but what we're trying to advocate for is all this new, to where it's like, please just try to think outside your box just a little bit, because you're doing exactly what we want you to do just with ketamine. Like, you're prescribing off-label drugs all the time, but they really don't understand that. So it's almost like it's like a court system. You got to like make the conclusion for them, and then let them have that. Like, oh, wait a minute. Every time I prescribe trazodone, I prescribe trazodone all the time. That's one of the most commonly used drugs in an off-label capacity that insurance continues to cover. You know, so any prescriber who's ever prescribed trazodone, you just broke the law, basically, you know, in their head with ketamine, if they were to prescribe ketamine in an off-label capacity. So, James, it's almost like we're dealing with people that are developmentally delayed. They can only see their path, and they can't see that anybody else exists in this world except their world. And that's, you know, that's where we're at right now. And it sucks because people are dying because of our ignorance.
Well, that mirrors the fire service. I mean, I'm trying to make the point for a shorter work week so we can give our first responders time for rest and recovery. The average firefighter works 56 hours a week. You have a recruitment crisis now because of the devolution of working environments, and now people don't want to do this job anymore. So now one mandatory overtime, one, you know, 7 a.m. phone call, you can't go home after all. Now it's an 80-hour work week. And again, all the evidence is there. Like I've said, even forget evidence. If the way we did it worked, then we would have healthy firefighters and no recruitment crisis. But, you know, they're so indoctrinated by the way they think that even the firefighters themselves push against it. And it's crazy. And again, like you said, you want to break down the walls of the box and say, look, look around you, you know, and you know, comprehend these deaths that are happening at the same, you know, these men and women in the same uniform as you. So this, I see the same resistance even in my own profession in a different way, but the same issue is just the inability to critically think. But I think, again, that comes from this kind of divisive, highly stressed society that we're in now, as people lack the ability to just stand back and take it in for a moment and go, does this make sense?
And I think a big piece with that, right, is, and that's the beautiful thing with psychedelics, is it's allowing all these specialists to come in. So, like, I don't know veterans, I don't know firemen, I don't know pharmacy, but you all understand those languages. So it's almost like when we go to the FDA or we go to the DEA or whomever else, we have to sit down and be like, okay, tell me how your system works. And if we can understand how their system works, then we build what we need to put into that system. And then they'll be able to empathize with it and connect with it. So, you know, it's like if I walked in, I was like, oh, I'm an anesthesia provider, I can do all this stuff. It's like people are like, oh, whatever, you put people to sleep. Like you don't know anything, you know. Or if I came in and instead said, you know, like if I was at a pediatric conference and I was like, hey, this is, you know, when I work with children who have brain tumors, this is something that we see. Well, right there, I've connected with them because they're like, oh, she knows about kids' brain tumors and we're at a pediatric conference. Now, all of a sudden, I have broken down that communication barrier to where it's starting to be more open and people's tail feathers aren't getting, you know, stuck up kind of thing. So it's really, I mean, and physicians are one of the worst. And I asked my ex-husband, I asked him, I said, what is this? Like, you know, because you can't go in and say that you're going to educate a physician. And he's like, well, actually I was going to go say that. And he said, if you go in and say you're going to educate a physician, he said, they will slam the door in your face and tell you to get out because they are the highest educated professionals in the world. If you change your terminology and say, I have new information for you to help treat your patients better, then they're going to be like, oh, wow, you're going to get me better outcomes? I'm like, that's it. I'm getting you better outcomes, right? So we're feeding their egos. So an issue that we have to realize is, like, we've got to put our egos down a little bit so we can at least try to get into the door so we can feed their egos, right? Because that's how you're going to get things passed, is how can what I'm doing help you from a political standpoint? How's it going to make you advocate for your people better? How's it going to decrease cost of the system? Like, what are they looking for? And if we can see what they're looking for, then we can we can learn how to negotiate better. And I mean, maybe David knows that in the veteran space, it's all about negotiation and mediation. That's what it's all about.
Well, David, we talked about your healing journey. I want to get to, you know, the therapies that are offered and what you collectively are trying to do as far as, you know, moving forward and even prevention. What was it that brought you into this group to now be part of the solution for your fellow veterans?
James, pretty simple. Our veterans, our first responders, deserve better. We know the problems, and we know what causes the problems. You know, I need to look, if I look at Helena, if I look at deployments in Iraq, if I look at deployments in Afghanistan, if I just look at the fires in California, we know that they're going to cause problems. What we can't afford to do any longer is wait until that problem is there in front of us. We've got to get ahead of it. Curing doesn't work, but preventing will help that individual, will help their families, will help their communities, will help their businesses. That's what gets me into the space. Is if I look at my journey, it was painful. Hurt me and it hurt my family. That's what drives me. And I think if I look at how do we get there, one, we have now got this ability with this bot to identify your risk of having a mental health episode. That gets us ahead. I'm no longer waiting for you to have the episode. We've got an idea that you are at risk of having an episode. We can now give you help. We can give you support. We can give you treatment. And if I move into using psychedelic-assisted therapies, there's a real solution, because we already are gathering the evidence that they work, that they give you your life back.
So talk to me about the bot. Yeah, please. Let's open that up.
Katie, go on.
So James, oh, actually here, James, this is all from you, buddy. This is all from our first conversation, was when I was describing ketamine and, how there was a police officer, and I wish we could find who he was. But he was a police officer, reached out to me after our podcast, because I was describing to you how ketamine works, and you said, so it kind of unfucks the brain. And I said, yeah, unfucks it. And that was when, police officer reached out, said, I listened to your podcast on James's show and I went and got treatment. You saved my life. Thank you. If you ever made a shirt that said unfuck it, I would buy it. So I went down this like category, you know, that's how I created the unit initiative and all this other stuff. But I created a scale, and my scale is 5 questions, and the 5 questions actually has been validated with over 12,000 people, and it cross correlates depression, anxiety, PTSD, insomnia, suicidality. And the 5 questions are kind. Because I just know when people struggle, literally that breath of wind might be the last thing that pushes them over the edge, just because everything's just so, you know, hypersensitive. So created the scale, and I called it the Federal Unit Conservative, or the Federal Unit Conservative Kinesiologic Investigational Task Force Scale, which actually stands for fuck it. But we're just allowed to call it Federal Unit Scale. But just so you know, its name was birthed through your podcast. But anyway, because, you know, there's something about controlling your own narrative from that standpoint. But we got the scale validated. That draft manuscript should be published, actually, in the Journal of Psychiatric Research soon. And then we were able to work with our science team. They made an AI bot. It's an avatar. It can actually talk to you with these 5 questions and go back and forth. And it gives you a number, 0 bad, 100 good, and whatever in between. So it's not saying, oh, James, you're bad. It's saying, oh, you're a 30. Well, let's try to work to a 50 or whatever you want to work to, right? So it's all about recontexting the way that we look at mental health, realizing all of us have a score, everybody, you know, and it might be good, it might be bad, but you can always improve it. So the bot is geared to deploy across the world, to where we can start measuring people preventatively through risk mitigation, because we're all at risk, because we don't know what causes all this stuff yet.
And James, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. Hmm? It's your facial expressions, it's how do you speak, what do you do. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it measures your, so believe it or not, James, we have 22 emotions in every conversation that we have. All of us right now are having 22 emotions, and she measures your, like, yeah, your facial expressions, your tone, to where after the review or after you talk to her, she gives you a summary of your conversation. And then she also shows you on a bar graph where you are with these 22 emotions, because you may say, we may be like, hey, James, I think you've got some anger issues. And you're like, I don't have any anger issues. Like, if anything, like, I don't have anger, I suppress anger, you know, whatever. But if you're able to go and look at this review and it shows that your tiredness is off the scale, like, we could be like, oh yeah, I'm just tired all the time. If it's showing that, then maybe we need to take steps in order to lower that bar graph down, or to improve the joy. I mean, because it does like joy, distress, all these different pieces, but it just gives you an analysis. So if we're able to get this bot, and this is something that David and Nick and I are actually working on, is getting the bot in the psychedelic space, so it can be the one piece that analyzes everybody. It's like, I don't care if you're in the jungle, if you're in Europe, if you're in Asia, it doesn't matter. I don't care what psychedelic you're doing. It's an agnostic scale and bot that's been made to advocate for you. It's not advocating for a product like the other scales are out there with medications. You are the product. So whatever you do, whether that be diet change, yoga, meditation, antidepressants, psychedelics, it's going to show how you are doing. And that's what we missed in mental health. There is nothing that's advocating for you. So simple, but nobody's done it, right? So that's the cool piece with the bot. And it is, it's fascinating. So hopefully we can get that eventually approved to be an FDA device.
Nick, jump in.
I
He loves it. It's the best thing he's ever seen.
Ultimately, like high level, like where I have a deep appreciation for the bot is when I think about mental health and the way we have care delivery currently. A lot of patients are going to meet, potentially like appointments are only 6 minutes. So it's a snapshot in time in a busy schedule. They walk right out the door. And the idea to have longitudinal information that's able to assess voice, able to assess facial features, able to have just like a more of a video reel as opposed to just a 6 minute snapshot brings a tremendous value. If therapist or psychiatrist or other mental health care provider is able to have data points before walking into a room for a patient, they're just better equipped. And like some of the technology coming out for the space is just like fascinating and really, really high value. This being one, I imagine a world as well where there's like, there's some really neat technology coming out for like with vibrations and sound. I imagine before going into appointments, there's almost like reset, no medicine involved before going into an appointment to break that space of getting out of a car after a rushed visit during your lunch hour to like go to a therapist to talk and just having like resets and continuity. It will be so vital in the upcoming years.
And it could, and what we just talked about, it could address that gap of our stupidity or ignorance in the field, and it would give us something like, oh, wow, look, this color's higher than this color. We should look on that one, so it actually puts some tangible aspects so we can become better providers. Because again, we are not good.
You know, it'd be a really interesting, and I'm curious, James, question back to you here. Because of the individuals that you're working with and the level that you work with, are you seeing anything on like the presumptive law side for departments? So like job-related injury for firefighters or frontline workers?
What I'm seeing, and it's very sad, is that there are some states that have some presumptive laws. For example, I know some states, let's say you have a presumptive law for cancer, but if women are over a certain age, then breast cancer isn't covered, even though they've worked for 20 years as a firefighter. There's some presumptive laws on the mental health side as well, PTSD. Mm-hmm. But what I've heard from many, many people is just because you have a presumptive law doesn't mean they're going to pay out. And these insurance companies will fight tooth and nail to the point where some have reported literally hearing them say, well, we'll just fight them and they'll die. They'll die before they ever get a penny. Oof. So this is kind of the landscape that we're dealing with. I'm sure there's some that are great and they just, take care of their people. That's not the stories I'm hearing more often than not.
Okay.
David.
Thanks for context on that. Yeah, I know like Maine, Florida, I think Colorado, some other states have some, but I wasn't sure about actual outcomes on implementation.
Yeah, I know it's a fight. David, you mentioned about needing to close out in an hour. Did you need to, if there's anything you want to leave us with before you step out?
I think now, well, James, yeah, I'm very sorry that I've got to go because I think it's a great conversation. The bit for me is we've got to do better. The joy is we can do better.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I wanted to get just kind of circle around to the comments that you guys made. When I think about being a paramedic, one of the most important concepts to me was trending. You might have someone in cardiac arrest or whatever it is, but it's over the journey in the ambulance or whatever it is, or even it's my family's health. How are they doing today, tomorrow, 5 days? Okay, it's looking good. We're trending upwards. That's beautiful. It seems like this AI bot that you've got will give someone the ability to see how they are trending because it's not something you can normally annotate. So if you do have someone with depression or anxiety or, God forbid, even suicide ideation, is there an ability then to be, oh, well, I was a 16 yesterday and now I'm a 24. I could see that would almost give them hope. And they're doing cold plunges or ketamine or whatever it is. And like, oh, this is working. This is working.
Yeah. Yes. And here's the really cool thing, James, is with this, like antidepressants have been covered, 90 days. Well, here's what's happening in the psychedelic space right now. You're getting veterans, great job vets for coming out and saying, you saved my life. The FDA can't hear it. We've got to put it in the language that they can hear. And the language that they can hear is seeing data change. So that's the, you know, so if we're able to get somebody to use this bot for a year and just do it, like do psychedelics, go do ayahuasca, go do ibogaine, go do whatever you want to do, and then do the bot once a month. And then we can have that longitudinal data to where maybe we can prove that people are in remission. And then we can give more insight. And if you can, the more insight you can give, the more that we're able to decrease that fear factor. Because people are afraid. They're afraid of all these things. But a lot of times, unfortunately, we have to hit rock bottom before we get help. And that's what we need to prevent, is to say, like maybe the scale, if you do hit into the 30s, then you need to get help, even if you don't feel like you need to get help, you know? So it's just something, it's like your red blood cells. If your red blood cells are off, do you feel like a bad person because of it? No. You know, so if we're able to put a number there instead of be like, oh, just tell me why you feel so bad. I mean, we're using people who can't even eat or drink as the primary indicator on if they need to get help. And it's like asking a computer that's malfunctioning to fix itself or to identify why there's an issue. It can't. So we're starting off on the wrong foot with all this. So if the bot, yes, if the bot can just show these numbers over time, when are you optimally functioning? Oh, when I'm like a 65, I'm optimally functioning. Okay, great. Stay at 65. You know, but yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's going to be life changing. I really, 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 really do. But I'll send you the draft manuscript. It's fascinating. And we got a lot of really cool people that are behind it, and they're all big Ivy League scientists, and they're doing it because they know there is better out there. They're not doing it to make a dollar. They're doing it because they see that they need to contribute to history, and this is going to be very contributing to history.
Okay. I want to put something to both of you just quickly. There's a phrase I love: don't wait for science to prove what you already know is true. And I'll give you a perfect example. Again, this resistance to changing the work week. People will tell me, oh, we need to see studies. And what they're asking is, can you show me in a laboratory study that a 42-hour work week will be healthier than a 56-hour work week? And there's a certain point where you got to draw a line in the sand and go, we don't need a study for this. I don't need a study to know that if I stand in front of a moving bus that I'm going to get flattened. You know, where is that point of common sense? So, you know, why is it in some of these things that, you know, we're all seeing are very, very effective. And arguably, if we're talking about the plant medicine, really, we've got hundreds of years of studies, you know, as far as history and indigenous cultures. Why is this roadblock of studies so high in some of these areas?
Nick, you want to take that one on?
So many pieces there. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to DEA scheduling. If we really were to get to like a first principles aspect of regulation. So the idea that many of these medicines are in phase two or phase three clinical trials with rigorous scientific research, and they're still DEA scheduled one, meaning they're restricted and there's no medical value. Marijuana being an additional component there, despite being legalized, I don't know, 30 or 40 states, I have no idea how many, is still a Schedule I federal substance. And the idea that for these agents, what was the quote you said? Don't wait for science to prove what you already know. And the idea that if we took the collective voice of all of these individuals, and I only advocate for legal access, just to be clear on that, but all these individuals who maybe they're going out to the jungle and they're risking it in like some hut with some shaman, or all these individuals going down to Mexico or outside of the country, even if they fought for our own country, and the collective voice is saying this helped leaps and bounds more than what conventional insurance covered care provided for me within the US. And I took it on my own accord to leave the country to go for this. We need to listen to those people. Like despite like whatever our political perspective is, whatever our viewpoint is, like there's, I mean, it's proven if we listen to the voice to an extent. Where my interest and intrigue lies from like a scientific lens is like, who is this working for? What type of people? Is there harm? What kind of harm? Right, if we look at the MDMA research, 71% are no longer diagnosable, 88% had benefit, but there's a 12% that
if we're real, like 12% didn't have that benefit. So who are those 12%? How do we like really like siphon those people out initially so we could focus on the 88%, which is massive, massive, considering that we currently have 60% treatment resistance or drug discontinuation with our current mental health care model. Like, that's the direction we need to go. And I think states like Oregon and Colorado are really, really interesting case studies with legal access to psilocybin-assisted therapy for wellness or for mental health care. And a leading indicator that'll have some really interesting data within the U.S. that we could bring to regulators.
Kate, anything to add?
No, I think you summed it up really, really well. But yeah, I think we're going to look back, and what you just said, our veterans are going to other countries to get help that they need. That's an instrumental statement, and it's very, very sad. It's very sad that we, being in the United States, cannot provide that care for them. And but yet, what isn't scheduled, and I mentioned this the other day with Nick, alcohol. Alcohol is a mind-altering drug. It can also be utilized as a non-regenerative psychedelic per se, but it's not scheduled, and it's everywhere, right? I mean, if anything needs to be a Schedule One, it needs to be alcohol. But we need to de-schedule take them out of the Schedule One classification with psychedelics, and put them, you know, more than likely on a Schedule Three, to where we can give people access. It's like, what are we doing? And hopefully the new administration that just came in is going to help with some of this stuff, because so much of this as to what we talked about today, none of it makes sense. Like it just doesn't make sense anymore. And we just need to change our view and build the new system.
Yeah. Well, and also not making sense in the way that, you know, the app works on your phone, that your TV channel, you know, changer doesn't work properly. That doesn't make sense. That's fine. No one's dying there. But in what we're talking about today, what doesn't make sense is costing lives. And this is why it's such an important conversation.
And not only is it costing lives, it's costing lives for generations to come. So when you lose your mom, when you lose your dad, when you lose your child, it has such catastrophic impact on our society that it decreases, you know, like the how much people are actually able to work, how much the income they're able to bring in. Like, you know, on so many different economic levels, this is having it's an impact we don't even know how bad it is.
Absolutely. Well, let's just talk about solutions then. Talk to me about anyone listening now, where they can access, you know, ketamine, whether it's through, you know, your own company or whether it's in other areas around the country. And then what else should we be looking for? You mentioned the AI bot. You know, what is the next step to try and bring this solution to more people?
Oh, that's a good loading question right there, James. So of course they can go to Revitalist. There are, you know, there's about 5,000, Nick may know, ish. There's 5,000-ish ketamine clinics across the United States, maybe more. Good, bad, or ugly, right? They're all different. They all have different modalities of. But one thing that we're doing, James, is yes, we've got the AI bot, but the other piece is we're opening a lab in February to where we're drawing blood, doing brain scans, doing heart scans. So it's a 4-minute EEG. It's a 4-minute EKG. We're seeing the real-time electrical patterns, and we're seeing how those cross-correlate with blood based on the inflammatory cascade. So we're seeing that stress on the system causes inflammation. Inflammation causes dysfunction. And that's what we want to do, is to like reverse engineer treatment, so we can get up here and we can start figuring out like how do we minimize that stress on the inflammatory cascade? And then how do we also help people to have more data to prove that their diagnoses are real? Because you shouldn't walk around with 38 diagnoses. You know what that means? You've had 38 wrong practitioners, more than likely. You know, and they all have their own different lens and view and whatever else. It's like, you know, we just need to have, the brain is one. What's the brain doing wrong? And what symptoms is it giving you? And how can we reset the brain? So then once the lab comes out, James, it's a reference lab. Anybody across the world can send us blood. Anybody can partner with us across the country and the world. So our goal is that we can have somebody come in once a year, right? Once a year you come in, you get your brain scan, your heart scan, your blood. I don't care if you feel good or bad or whatever. Just come in. We don't have to talk about your childhood trauma. We don't have to talk about, you know, the trauma, whatever, right? Whatever's been in your life. We don't have to talk about that. Just come in. Let's just look at the data and let's do interventions that can treat the data, because psychedelics and ketamine, they're huge anti-inflammatories, and not anti-inflammatories that they're like, you know, blocking the inflammatory system. They're auto-regulating the inflammatory system to where it's actually starting to function better. So we're trying, but I tell you, it's not an easy path at all.
Well, that would affect cancer and heart disease and other areas too. And this is the thing, even with NuCom, when he's down regulating with that technology, you know, he's talking about cancer, he's talking about aging. I mean, when you're carrying that trauma, as they say, the body keeps the score, it's going to affect everything.
Yep. And that's a piece, right? So I've actually, when I told you, you know, we've got to give people conclusions. That's the way I set up the lab is I have actually on the forms, it just has the diagnosis there. So if you're obese, if you have diabetes, if you have fibromyalgia, if you have TBIs, CTEs, depression, anxiety, insomnia, you just circle what you're feeling at that moment. And we've actually made protocols behind that. Well, that will draw all the labs behind that protocol. So that's the piece, right? Is we're trying to make it, gosh, we're just trying to make it to have just a very small level of statistical error. That's the goal. Cause right now, like I said, it's all error. That's all we know in the mental health system. And burnout with providers is 50% or greater. How do we stop that? How do we give them more tools? Right. And here's my analogy that I tell people, because again, it's like new language skills. If you break your leg and you go to the emergency room, if you think your leg's broken, you go to the emergency room. You don't go and see the orthopedic surgeon first, who's looking at you like, oh, is James grimacing enough? Is his leg look swollen enough? You know, well, I guess I'm going to have to go in blindly and just cut him open and see what's in there. No, you do an x-ray. You know, so that's where the bot will come in. That's where the lab will come in, is we can give these people data markers that they can look at. Then they can look at your diagnosis, because people are getting diagnosed in like 5 minutes, 7 minutes, and absolutely not. It's negligence. It's malpractice. It's all the negative legal jargon we want to throw in there. But it's, again, it's just ignorance. It's the system's not where it needs to be.
Just reminded me, and I don't know anything about the background of this particular video, but someone was in the street and they were interviewing, I think it was psychiatrists, and they were said, how many patients have you cured? And over again, each of these different people was saying none. And so when you talk about the burnout, being compassionate and empathetic for the provider, whether it's, you know, an ER physician or nurse, that's just seeing all these obese patients coming in, and obviously us, the paramedics that are literally intubating them and defibrillating them, and they die over and over and over again. That inability to improve or inability to save is incredibly detrimental to someone who wanted to serve, someone who wanted to alleviate pain. So this shift, I hope, helps the practitioners too.
That's the goal of it, you know, and they're all in the mental health space again, because I hear things, I'm like, no, it don't work like that. It's so different, James. They're just trained differently in the mental health space. As therapists don't have to have peer-reviewed journals. They don't have them. They don't exist. In medicine, that's all we have is peer-reviewed journals, right? You got to present your case, hope it gets eaten, then you draft it, and then it gets eaten again, you draft it again. But therapists don't have that right now. So they're looking for a bot. They're like, oh, does your bot diagnose? No, it doesn't diagnose. Why are you calling it diagnostic marker? It's like, because it's giving you data to help you diagnose, because you all suck right now. You know, so like it's, you know, and that's the piece. It's like they're looking for a bot to diagnose. Guys, we don't even have the language on how to effectively diagnose. How are we going to make a bot that diagnoses yet? Like, we don't have the large language model. We don't see it yet. And AI, in order to build AI, you have to give it a large language model, and the large language model doesn't exist. So yeah, I'm hoping it's going to help out providers, healthcare, communities, schools. Here's another thing, James, I think we've talked about this before. In the school system, I asked one of the teachers, When do your kids kill themselves the most? What's the highest? What's the highest? When's the highest rate of occurrence? Oh, we don't know. It's random. No, it's not random. There's a pattern somewhere. How have you looked at the pattern? Well, we don't know how to look at that. So if we can get the bot into schools, it can show when these children are decreasing, when we need to put more support around them. And that's how we prevent. We've got to get out there and we've got to start surveying the landscape from an agnostic viewpoint. Right now, we're only surveying the landscape when people are rock bottom, or they feel stressed to ask for help, or they're scared and they ask for help. So all the data that we see is very skewed.
Yeah, I had a personal experience. I'm sorry, say again.
I said, but I'm very hopeful for the future.
Well, I think this is the good thing. A crisis is the perfect time to turn the ship around. But yeah, with the school thing, I had an issue with my son, and he was, I mean, just basically malpractice of what happened to him, and it traumatized him for years and years and years after that. So, you know, you're mm-hmm. preaching to the choir there. Well, Nick, anything to add on this last kind of close out element?
Ooh, great conversation, James. This was a blast. I appreciate you. Appreciate you having us all. And I think ultimately the pathway, which I feel like we're all in alignment, is like, first, it's finding balance in life. If we go through a lab pathway, it's like, how do we balance our hormones? How do we balance our electrolytes? How do we balance our nutrition? And then there's these deeper tools available. Ketamine, we know, is effectively a therapy accelerant available nationwide. Clinicaltrials.gov is a really, really great resource for individuals seeking legal access, legal regulated access for various modalities within the US. And I'm optimistic about the future. And I feel like this post-COVID trauma era has really been rough on society as a whole. So all we can do is build forward.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you both. This has been a great conversation. We were kind of joking at the beginning. We didn't know where it was going to go as far as the dynamic, because I mean, you've got these amazing concepts and we're kind of unpacking now what hopefully the future looks like. But, you know, between David, who's left us now, so we won't be able to say goodbye to him, and you, Katie and Nick, I want to thank you for such an amazing conversation and being part of the solution. You know, when we question the things that are broken, that we see do not work anymore, and we're able to bring solutions into the conversation, I've been calling out cowardice a lot recently. At what point do we stop burying our people and actually have the courage to stand up and say this needs to change? And I think this, you know, what we've discussed today, whether it's ketamine, the AI bot, or even psychedelics that we need to bring into the country, not our veterans and first responders have to leave the very soil they're protecting to get the healing that they need. I think it's extremely exciting. So I want to thank you both so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Well, and thank you for all of your advocacy, too. Mm-hmm. You've saved a lot of lives.
Yep.
And we'll continue.
Absolutely.